And hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are on the web at kuci.org, streaming live. And after this show airs, we will podcast within a few days. So you can listen again, or maybe you're listening for the first time on the podcast. If you want to subscribe to that, go to iTunes and look for Writers on Writing and subscribe. And when we podcast a new show, you will receive notification of that in your podcast file. So I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're here every Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. This morning, I have David R. Gillum and Jana Clare. First up is David R. Gillum. David is the New York Times bestselling author of City of Women. He studied screenwriting at the University of Southern California before transitioning to fiction. After moving to New York City, he spent more than a decade in the book business and now lives with his family in Western Massachusetts. And his newest novel is Annalise, and I hope that's how you pronounce it. If not, he will correct me. Published by Viking. And it's a fascinating novel. I can't wait to talk to him. Let's bring him on. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you, Barbara?
Good. Now, did I pronounce that right?
You did, in fact, pronounce it correctly.
All right. So let's begin by you talking about the inspiration for Annalise.
Well, it's a long story, actually. This journey for this book started about 30 years ago. I was reading a book by Philip Roth called The Ghostwriter, and it was the first novel that Roth introduces his character of Nathan Zuckerman, and the young writer, and he meets this young woman who's a refugee from Europe, and in his head, Nathan decides that this young woman is Anne Frank, having survived, and writes the story about it. And in the end of the book, he realizes that it was just a fantasy that he was having, and that this woman isn't actually Anne Frank. But I really enjoyed the book. It really stuck with me. But I hadn't ever read Anne Frank's diary at that point. So I was moved to pick it up, and I read the diary, and I was just simply thunderstruck by it. I was so moved by her, you know, deep perception and her ability and her craft of this, you know, young 15-year-old who writes with such authority, and I was just astonished by it, and I guess I became, to use the word, obsessed with Anne Frank for quite some while. I did paintings about her. My wife says that she is my muse, and that may be true. So I, as a fiction writer, all I could do was write about fiction. So I decided I must write a book about Anne Frank. And about 28, I tried to do it, and it failed miserably. I couldn't get close to her. I think she was too iconic. I sort of circled around the character, and so I put it aside. And then about, a number of years later, in the late 90s, I picked it up again. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try this again. And I did try it again, and it also failed. I wrote the first page, which actually is still the first page of the book. But after that, the narrative got murky. I didn't know where to place her. I had her in the United States as a teenager. That just didn't work. So I put it aside a second time. And then after City of Women, I picked up the idea a third time. And that time, for reasons I still don't quite understand, but maybe I just had the horses to do it this time, it started to open up for me. And I decided on the narrative of Anne surviving the camps and returning to Amsterdam, where her father, the only other survivor, was living in 1946, right after the war. And that narrative, the conflict and the relationship between those two characters, Anne and her father, are really at the heart of this book.
So that's a long time to have a book in your head, or at least somewhere in there in your subconscious. So what made you keep coming back to it?
Well, I think it was just such an important idea for me personally. I was such a great admirer of Anne's work, and I wanted to pay it homage in some way, and in the way that I best could do it would be through what I did, which is writing fiction. So I think I was pursued by the idea rather than the other way around, that I could just not let it rest until I actually managed to write the book. My wife actually also has an idea that maybe I needed to be a father for a decade or so before I could even approach this book. So that may have had something to do with it, too, to know about what that relationship between parent and child from both sides can be like.
Yeah. So when you would revisit the material, would you start over with the old material, or would you read it over and then start anew, or how did that process go? Because I think there's like a lot of writers who become obsessed with a project and they keep trying to make it work by revising and revising, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that process. I'm trying to make this work, and I will make this work by simply rewriting the same 150 pages. I've done that with other projects, but not this one. The first time I tried it, they were all three different approaches, I think I should say. I spent a lot more time the first time I tried it when I was 28, literally just following her day by day after the Franks and her family, or the Franks and her friends, rather, were arrested. And I actually did use a few sections of that from 30 years ago in Annalise, but, a few pages here and there, a description of Camp Vesterbork. But the story itself I had set aside. Second time around, it was the same thing. I wrote that first page, which is how the book begins, which is really she comes back to life at that moment when, instead of dying, she lives. I did write that first page, but then the narrative about her as a teenager, she had two uncles on her mother's side, and this is real, who had emigrated to the United States from Germany in the 30s. And they lived in Leominster in Massachusetts. And I had a story of her as a teenager living, near them. And it just didn't work. It was too oppressive. There was no spark to it. So I set that aside. And I didn't use any of that again. And then I started this story, and this one was 1,000 pages long in the first draft. I actually took her from Amsterdam as a teenager, and then jumped ahead into her in her 30s living in New York City. That proved just too monstrous an idea, and 1,000 pages. It just didn't work. So I actually cut the second half of the book free, basically, and concentrated on that first narrative with her father and her.
So speaking of real, you said, and this is real. So I'm thinking about historical fiction. And where is the line between fact and fiction? I mean, what do you need to pay attention to when you're writing historical fiction, and what is okay to fabricate?
Well, I'm a stickler for historical detail. I always have been in what I read and what I write. I lot of research over the years, books, videos, accounts of survivors. I've visited Amsterdam. I've been inside the flat they lived in before they went into hiding. I visited the Anne Frank house where they were in hiding several times. I've seen the camps, Westerbork and Auschwitz-Birkenau and Bergen-Belsen, where she and Margot died. I've been to all those places. So I tried to make it the environment always throughout the book as realistic as possible. As far as the actual facts of Anne's life, I followed them in the first part of the book, where the first part of the book takes place when she first receives the diary when she's 13 years old, living under occupation of the Germans, but still, you know, still a young person, excited about schoolmates, etc. And they move into hiding and then are arrested and taken to these various camps. And I do have scenes in all of those places. And in those cases, the action is fictional, is imagined, because, you know, it has to be. There's no record of exactly mm-hmm. what went on at the dinner table in their flat before they went into hiding. The dialogue I may imagine, but situations I took from my research. So I tried to make them as realistic as possible. Now, of course, when she comes back to life after the war and comes back to Amsterdam, that's all imagined. But again, within the context of the environment that I place her in, the events that are happening, the historical events that are happening, all that is as realistic as I could make it.
So is the estate important? If there's an active estate for a deceased historical figure, notable, is there a lot of vetting that goes on? Or because it's fiction, are you able to do whatever you want?
Well, I tried to be very... I always have been very respectful of Anne's legacy, and the character herself I tried to build in a very deep but, you know, honoring way to pay homage to her. But, you know, writing fiction, there are things you have to make up. So if that answers your question, I mean, do you mean, did I need to...
Well, you know, it's like with memoir. If you're doing memoir and you're dealing with a deceased figure, uh-huh. there's a lot. What I've heard from friends of mine who write these sorts of books is there's a lot of dealing with the estate lawyers and them approving or disallowing certain aspects to be written about. And I'm just wondering how it changes with fiction.
Yeah, I think that situation is a little different mm-hmm, with fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That since you are telling a fictional story or
right.
even a real story in a fictional manner, it's not the same thing. These are not the real people who I'm talking about. These are my characters,
yes.
Anne, Pim, Margot,
mm-hmm.
et cetera.
Hmm. Well, I'd love to hear you read.
I'd be happy to.
Excellent. And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with David R. Gillum. His book is Annalise, published by Viking.
Okay, the scene I'm about to read is takes place after Anne has survived Bergen-Belsen, which is the camp, the last camp in Germany where she and her sister, in reality, both perished. Margot is gone, though, and Anne is in a DP camp in a hospital, and when Margot returns. At night, she finds Margot sitting on the edge of her bed, but she does not scream or shout out for help. For an instant, the smallest pinprick of hope stabs her. But there's really no fooling herself. There is no life remaining in her sister's gaze. Margot has simply followed her from the mass graves into the hospital block. Her hair is matted, her lips cracked. Her eyes hang open like swallowing caves. The yellow star is pinned to the dirty brown pullover that she wears over striped lager breeches. Oddly, the aberration is comforting. "You can't just lie here, Anne," Margot tells her. "You have to get up." Anne manages carefully and very slowly to prop herself up onto her elbows. "They won't send you back home until you can walk." "And where," Anne wonders dimly, "is home exactly?" "Where? Don't be silly. Amsterdam? I should consider Amsterdam my home still? Without you, without Mummy, without Pim?" "You cannot be sure about Pim," Margot tells her. "There is still a chance." "No, Pim is gone," Anne says flatly. "You don't know that for certain." "I do. How could he have lived through Auschwitz? He was old, Margot, 55 years old. How could he possibly have survived a selection?" "Oh, so you are the authority on life and death. You know very well how things worked. The Germans made it perfectly clear. The only way out was up the chimney. They probably gassed him on the very first night." "You don't know that for certain," her sister repeats more forcibly. "And what do you know for certain, hmm?" Anne frowns. "You're dead." "I know this much. As long as you remain lying here in this bed like a lump of self-pity, you will remain a lump of self-pity. I know that you must stand up and walk. That's what I know." Anne looks into Margot's face and feels a keen edge of loneliness saw into her. In the morning, a clatter of bedpans wakes her. She breathes in deeply as she sits up on her cot and goes, and ever so gingerly, slides her legs out from under the bedclothes. Her legs are little more than sticks, but she has feet that touch the wooden floorboards. She gazes down at herself. Her skin is pockmarked with scabs. The Red Cross nurse appears by her bedside and, clucking noisily, shifts her back under the covers. She is, of course, too weak to resist. She cannot receive a resisting anything at all. But when the nurse exits the ward, she tries again. Slowly, she grips the wooden headboard as firmly as she can manage. Her legs feel brittle, and her body burns as if her papery muscles might shred. But marshaling all her puny strength into the effort, she rises. At first, it is too much. Twice she plops back down onto the hard mattress. The third time, her arms shiver with the strain, but suddenly she feels a lightness filling her up, and she lifts herself up from the bed as if she is a balloon on a string floating upward. Her legs tremble as they take on the negligible weight of her body, but they do not snap. A tingle of dizziness washes through her head. But then she feels the meek comfort of the warm floorboards on the soles of her feet. She is standing.
Mm. Thank you so much. You know, I'm so curious why you chose, how you came to choose the third person present tense. Did you, when you were writing or trying previous drafts, had you cast it in different points of view?
That's simply how I write. I always write in the present tense. It's just the fashion that I feel most comfortable in. I feel like it brings in an immediacy to the scenes, but allows the reader, you know, just a little bit of distance when they need it to be able to understand what the character is doing, even if the character doesn't quite get it yet.
Yeah, and the present tense as a reader makes you feel like, well, the character doesn't know how this is going to end. You know, right. We're kind of in process with the character.
That's right. Yeah, and I feel like that's very effective.
Hmm. So I wanted to ask you about screenwriting, because in your bio, you know, it talks about you studying screenwriting and at USC and then transitioning to fiction. What about that? Why did you do that? What moved you about fiction that you wanted to go that way?
Well, I started out when I was very young as a playwright, as a teenager and into my college years. And so I was interested in dramatic writing. And so when I went to USC, I went there because I thought, okay, screenwriting, that's really what I want to do, because I can, when I write fiction, I see it happening. You know, I describe what I see the people, the characters doing. I hear them. Sometimes I even cast actors in my head as characters, not in this case, most of the time, but so that I can get their voice and hear the dialogue. That's just, I sort of write with a cinematic attitude. But what I learned that I loved about fiction was the world that I could build within the pages that I felt wouldn't change. You know, I suppose 1,000 people can read a book that you've written, and yet that book is still the same in your head. I think I liked that idea of the unchanging nature of fiction to the writer themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Do you read aloud as you're writing?
No.
Interesting.
I tend to be a reviser as I go. I'll do 3-4 pages, and then I'll, the next day or the next session that I'm writing, I'll go back and revise those 3 pages as sort of a running jump into the next bit.
And then when you have a complete draft, what happens?
After I've finished the complete draft for the first time, I will go back and I will revise it again. And then at that point, I hand it over to my agent, usually, and my wife and other people who are reading it to get their opinions.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, I mean, writers, we all have different ways of working. And, you know, it's... you find what works for you. I find process so interesting amongst writers. It's really interesting.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine divided writers into plotters and pantsers. You know, the plotters are the ones who plot everything out, and the pantsers fly by the seat of their pants as they're working. And I am definitely in the pantser category. When I start something, I have only the vaguest idea of the direction I'm going to get to maybe a specific event, not even the end of the book necessarily, but and then I have a group of characters and I just start, you know, moving forward. I tell the story of something I'd written when I was younger where one of my characters committed a murder. And I did not know she was going to do it until the scissors was in her hands.
Yeah, that, you know, that's interesting. So with Annalise, how did you know when you reached the end? When was it over? You know, I mean, as you got into the book and you know, through it, could you then see the ending?
By the time I was... revising it, I knew pretty much where it was going to go. You know, as I said, that I had my first versions of this book were nearly 1,000 pages long, and those went all over the place. So I had the luxury, in one way, of writing a far too long book, you know, an overlong book that allowed me to sort of seat of my pants through the plot and experiment with different things and then go back and lop off what didn't work, knowing that this is that the ending or the climax was going to probably be around this section here, and I just needed to work that better and maybe bring in other characters to get to that point.
Interesting. David, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. That was David Gillam. His book is Annalise, published by Viking. There was so much we did not get to, which I wish we had, but, you know, half hour flies by, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have Jana Clare with us, so don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are on the web at kuci.org, and we're all over the place. Stitcher, iTunes. If you want to hear the show again, or you're just tuning in and you want to hear the first half, go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we podcast, you will receive notification, or I guess you'll just receive the file in your podcast file. So, and if you might be so kind as to leave us a review, that will help other people searching for the show to find it. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am back this time with Janet Clare. Originally from New York, Janet lives in L.A. with her husband and a small dog named for the town of Lucca, Italy. She studied at UC Berkeley and UCLA. Time is the Longest Distance is her first novel, available from Vine Leaves Press, and will be the subject of our talk today. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Barbara.
Oh, I finally am talking with you. Let's start with you talking about Time is the Longest Distance and how the book came about.
The book came about partially because a long time ago I had heard a story, true story, of an Australian man living in the United States for many years. And he went back to Australia for his father's funeral. And when he got there, he found out his father had had a whole other family on the other side of the country. And I always found it, of course, big country. I always found that just remarkable. And it just set me thinking about the whole idea of what we don't know, and also of the space. The country's always fascinated me. So vast spaces and secrets.
Hmm. So, you know, you had written an essay that was on Lit Hub in December, and in it you talk about how you had worked on this book for a long time and you threw everything out and then you started over, going from third person to first person. Talk yes. about that. Talk about throwing out the draft and starting over. And I'm curious if you used the old draft and if you, it was there, you know, on the table beside you as you started over, or did you just start fresh?
Probably it wasn't on the table beside me, that's for sure. But it was in my head, of course. And I had fallen in with great luck with a wonderful teacher who became a great mentor to me and many others. Unfortunately passed away, Les Plesko. Mm-hmm. A lot of California writers know of him. And I walked into his first class and just light bulbs went off. And we worked together for many years out of class, workshops. And at any rate, I walked in thinking I had some sort of a novel and realized I didn't in certain ways, many ways. And so I did. I started over. First person, I'm not sure if it was at his suggestion or not, to tell you the truth, but I discovered that it was a story that needed to be told from the first person. Definitely. Yes. It's very much a story of discovery and yearning.
Hmm. And there are so many themes running through the book. You know, fathers, daughters, daughters, mothers, you know, secrets. There's so much going on here. And when you're writing, are you thinking theme or are you thinking character and story? And at what point do you think theme or do you? Or is it something that readers tell you, oh, I love this, and this is what you were writing about, and you say, oh, that was a surprise to me.
Exactly. I think that's more often the case. Now, I don't think theme. I don't know of many writers that do. I think character, and I think place. And character and sort of the surprise of what they're going to do, because I'm not a writer who outlines at all. I have no idea where it's going. At some point, I do, I think. But I certainly don't have an end in sight. And there are writers I know who outline meticulously, and they know absolutely the last scene when they sit down to write the first one. I find that amazing. Mm-hmm. I could never do it. So I'm much more of, I guess, what would be considered an organic writer.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, the setting is so strong in this book. I expected you to have an Australian accent, and I mean, I knew you didn't, but you know, it felt like the writing, the writer of this book felt like somebody who had lived in Australia or at least spent quite a while there, and I understand you did travel there. but
I did not travel.
You
there.
Did not travel there. Oh my goodness.
I know.
Now that's
I
even know. More incredible. Okay.
It's always the question that gets asked, and I'd like to lie about it, but I can't. And I didn't. And you know, I did a lot of research, a lot of reading. Always fascinated by it. I think what helped me so much was that I had a number of years ago traveled alone to Africa, not totally alone, but not as a part of a tour, not with a companion, no one. And I think the idea of being in such a faraway place, so much out of my life and on my own, I was able to carry that idea that I had from Africa to another continent. I mean, it wasn't very difficult in that respect. So, because I've always been interested and become more so interested in the country, small towns, country, wherever I go, rather than large cities, which have become, while they're fascinating, then they're not so much anymore, to me at any rate. And so the country, the sky, the land, the animals, that's what's always appealing to me.
Well, it's working.
Thank you. That's a great compliment. I really appreciate it.
I would love to hear you read from Time is the Longest Distance.
Okay. All right. So I am going to read a bit. This is when Lily, the character, the protagonist in my book, first arrives at her father, her newfound father's home in Australia. Cameron's house was low-lying with a swath of untamed gardens, great piles of dying roses, fallen petals, leafy vines, and musty shrubs. The front door was slightly ajar. I'd invited myself, but he knew to expect me, so I knocked and pushed it open. "I'm out here." His voice was strong. I found my way through to a sunlit porch filled with potted plants and aging wicker furniture. Cameron sat on a cushioned chair, surrounded by books and newspapers, coffee cups and half-empty glasses. The air didn't move. He looked up from his paper. "You're Lily," he said without smiling. He didn't look as old as I'd expected. Plenty of gray hair, an oval face ending in a firm chin. I tried not to stare. "You're my father," I answered. "Did he expect me to run up and throw my arms around him?" "I didn't sleep last night," he said. "We should have put this off until tomorrow." "Really? Well, I hadn't slept much either. Nevertheless, I'd been dressed and ready for hours, having changed my clothes three times. I had on a white skirt and T-shirt, bright lipstick, my hair washed and blown dry, shined. I was here to meet my father. And he was tired? He'd had 45 years to rest. "I've traveled 14,000 miles, I said. Resigned, he waved me in. "Come closer." "What about please?" I didn't take orders well, but moved further into the porch, which was screened all the way around and had dusty bits of leaves, twigs, and small bugs clinging to the outside baseboard. "You could sit," he said. He adjusted his glasses, his wire frames tangling his hair, and squinted at me. His eyes were dark and deep-set like mine. He was clean-shaven and wore brown cotton pants with a freshly pressed white shirt. I wondered if he'd ironed it himself. I sat, trying to act casual, failing. "I brought us some lunch," I said, holding the bag aloft like evidence at a trial. Where I came from, food was a great leveler. He nodded. On the table beside him was a dog-eared copy of Crossing the Dead Heart and Bryson's in Sunburned Country. In the corner, a bag of potting soil overflowed, and the air smelled like things growing with the wet dirt aroma of mulch made of leaves and straw. There were lacy ferns and cracked pots and velvet African violets and other spidery-looking plants I'd never seen before. "You're tall," he said. "It's good to be tall." I didn't think so when I was a kid. He He pursed his lips like he was about to say something, but didn't. Was he wondering how I had been then? I didn't expect to ever see you, he said. You never tried. He didn't say anything. The air grew hotter. At one end of the porch, an elderly gray and white cat sat cradled in an ancient swing hanging from the ceiling by a rusted chain. Frayed grass mats covered the floorboards. How could you not want to know about me, I asked. He snorted, a rough laugh, as if it was a joke, and placed his hands on his knees, stretching his fingers, his knuckles like hard knots. I softened, thinking of arthritis, as he got up and took a few gliding steps, his worn loafers scratching the floor. He pulled at the wilted leaves of a plant, his back to me. I guess Ida told you everything, he said, turning with a shit-eating grin that gave me the creeps. Good teeth. I wondered if they were his. He sat back down. Not everything, I said. Almost nothing, really, just the bare minimum. Sunlight hit his face as he adjusted his chair. He was more weathered than old, and he didn't have the blue-veined, brown-spotted pallor of old men. Instead, the Australian sun had cast him permanent walnut, and I paled by comparison, like I'd just been born.
Thank you so much. That was Janet Clare reading from Time is the Longest Distance, published by Vine Leaves Press, an Australian publication, which I want to talk about in a minute. But I'm just so fascinated by the fact that this is so authentically Australian and you've never been there. I love that. And I want to hear a bit more about that. I mean, what sort of research did you do to really kind of lock in with this setting?
Well, you know, I read a lot of things, old kinds of things, especially about the canning stock route, which is the way they travel through the desert. I had come across a story about it, a newspaper story, I believe, and so I looked it up and found out how the early explorers had gone through that. And so I started with that, and of course, as mentioned here, Bill Bryson's famous In a Sunburned Country, which is a fabulous book, very accessible, and lots of things, you know, about Aborigine people, a lot of things, a lot of information about the flying doctors, which originally I actually had flying doctors in this book, and they fell by the wayside. But what I found with research is that you do it, and then you sort of forget it. You, like, let it seep into you somehow because you're not writing, you're writing a novel, you're not writing nonfiction. So you're not going to just, it's tempting sometimes to put in almost too much information, but you just sort of let it be there. And then it comes through. I think it comes through somehow. I don't know. I was asked by David Francis, who I know you were with recently, who's Australian and a writer and an attorney and rides horses. He's everything. You know, whether it would have changed my book if I had gone there during the writing, and which I found a really interesting question. And I thought, you know, because I was holding my image of it, and which seems to be working pretty well. And I thought that was really an interesting question. So I think if you're going to, as a writer, you're going to go to where a place where you want to write about, go first before you really sit down so that you can decipher it. Otherwise, it could start to interrupt where you are, I think, somehow in the writing. I don't know.
Yeah, and he gave you a nice blurb on the back of the book. So
he
must have approved of it.
Yes. And the mere fact that it was, you know, that it was published by an Australian publisher was sort of gratifying, to say the least. I mean, they're small, but they are Australian. So, well, you know, that was very gratifying.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, too, because you had an agent whom you fired. And then what? So why did you fire this agent? And then how did you find this press? Talk about that process of getting published.
Well, the agent I had, this book was written quite some time ago, changed somewhat during the time, but in between I've written one other completed. And at any rate, it found an agent in New York, and I was thrilled. And basically, as so many other stories about agents go, it didn't happen. She didn't do anything. I liked her a lot, and I clung to her because I blamed the book, of course, blamed myself, but she really didn't work on getting it out. And when I went on to write another one, and but I still stayed with her because I could say I had an agent in New York. It was like, oh, I have an agent in New York. She's useless, but I had her. But at any rate, I finally said, no, that's enough of that, and got rid of her, and nicely. And at any rate, just kept writing, you know, working on other things. And then it occurred to me that I really like this book, and I would like to see what I can do. And so it was just by sheer luck, I found this small publisher, sent off some pages. They liked it. They liked the book, and that was it. So that's how it happened. It was just happenstance in certain ways, you know, right time, right place. I don't know. So maybe it was the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. And I know, you know, when writers are frustrated, often the inclination is to just put it away and just get depressed, right? I mean, it's like, nothing's happening.
You can get depressed, but you can't stop working.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I mean, that's for me anyway. I once I got it, I got to do it. So you can't stop working no matter what.
Well, talk a little bit about the structure, because it alternates, the narrative alternates between Lily in Australia, going to Australia, and Lily, her past with her ex, her past with her mother. Talk a bit about that, how you came to that structure.
Well, it just, you know, I wrote scenes. I simply wrote you know, what came to me, what I was seeing at that particular time. I wasn't sure exactly how it was going to play out. I remember literally, because I was so new to it, laying the scenes out physically on the floor so I could see it, and how it should look, how it should feel. And, so I did, you know, going back sometimes doing flashbacks, you have to be careful because you don't want to get lost. You don't want to lose your original story in there. And so it just kind of seems to be the right balance. That's it. I think you just sort of have to get that right balance so that it feels comfortable. It felt comfortable for her, I think, to have the moments that she had. And again, of course, when you're out so far away from what you can think of as your real life, you tend to think of past, don't you? I mean, that's it. That's where memories come in, being alone, certainly.
Well, there's such a nice balance between the scenes and the narrative, the summary, the flashbacks. There, you know, sometimes I think writers get caught up in the narrative and forget to write the scene. You know, and I always, I'm looking at the material going, could I film this? How much of this is filmable? And it always seems that with today's fiction, you know, obviously this hasn't always been the case, but these days it seems that the novels that work best, or at least keep my attention, are maybe 3/4 scene and 1/4 narrative summary. I don't know. Maybe it's a little more even, but and yours was so nicely balanced. I just wondered if you paid attention to that, but it doesn't sound like you really thought about that.
No, not in the actual writing. Not in the actual writing. I think it's like other writers I'm sure work it differently, but I just do the scene and then see where it goes, and kind of go back over many drafts on the structure, which I know sounds odd, doesn't it?
No. I mean, we all have different ways of working, and I it's always fascinating. It's always fascinating to hear how different writers approach material and actually then have a book in hand, right?
Yeah, it is interesting. And you know, and just thinking about it, the idea of having the structure, if you're so wedded to it, then that would almost feel confining to me somehow, you know, but I don't know, whatever works.
What about, we have just a few minutes left, I think maybe three, and I'm curious about side characters, because Cameron, Grant, Jen, you have such powerful side characters that I very much saw as living, breathing people. What are you doing with your side characters that really makes them come alive?
Well, you know, I just think you have to see them somehow, and of course we're seeing them through her, and so I think it's in their movements. It's not just visually. You know, I don't think you always have to give the reader a complete visual of someone. I don't actually, you know, other than maybe, you know, she's a blonde or whatever, he's got red hair, something like that. Maybe you can do little sketches. But I think the reader can fill that in somehow, has a sense of them. I think it's always interesting to see if, you know, readers have a picture of especially a side character, what they got from it. It's in what they say. It's their movements. You know, it's how they speak to each other. That's who they become. I think that's the visual. I don't think you need lengthy big descriptions, frankly. Yeah.
I mean, you have telling details kind of sprinkled throughout the book, and so many sensory details that make the world, this Australian world that Lily has gone into, just so incredibly real. And
thank you.
You know, I loved it. So I'm glad you wrote it and saw it to the end. any last words or words of wisdom for the writers who are listening?
Oh gosh, no, I have no words of wisdom whatsoever, except for just do it. I ran across a young fellow in a bookstore the other day, and he said he'd been writing, and he was really young, and you know, all you could say is just don't stop, keep doing it, you know, and the same thing for anybody at any age, just do it, you know, because time's going to go by no matter what,
right?
Whatever you do it or not, so you might as well.
Janet, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was great fun. Loved it.
That was Janet Clare. Her book is Time is the Longest Distance, published by Vine Leaves Press. And check it out. I wanted to talk so much more about the book and sort of what else it did and does and why it works. And it's a small novel. And that's kind of interesting, too. It's I think I read it in one sitting. I read it on Saturday, maybe started it Friday night. And then Saturday, I was kind of glued to the couch. And when it was over, I kind of wished it would continue, actually. Sometimes, you know, you read a novel and you're grateful that it's over, right? Even if you love it. But I wanted more. And that's a nice way to be left by a book. Anyway, you've been listening to Writers on Writing. We're here every Wednesday. You can find us on iTunes. Look for Writers on Writing. And I'm still Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And you writers out there, remember to stay in the chair. Thanks for listening.